You're listening to episode 143 of the Writing Life podcast from the National Centre for Writing, a weekly podcast for anyone who writes. It's the 22nd of April 2021 here in Norwich as we're recording. I am Simon Jones.
And I'm Steph McKenna.
And we are joined by...
Peggy Hughes, hello!
You're back!
Guess who's back?
Yeah, so we're joined by Peggy today to talk about the very exciting City of Literature programme at this year's Norfolk and Norwich Festival. Later in the episode, we will be featuring an interview with writer Joe Lloyd, whose short story anthology, The Earth Thy Great Exchequer Ready Lies, came out earlier this year. Joe was also the winner of the BBC Short Story Award back in 2019, which seems about 100 years ago now, for her short story, The Invisible. So we'll get to that momentarily. But Peggy, NNF is rapidly approaching.
Oh, Simon, it is, you know. It's so exciting. I can hardly even believe May is just around the corner. But here we are, indeed.
And yeah, last year we had this kind of slight scrabble, didn't we, when everyone was trying to rethink and reconfigure everything for COVID times. And we kind of went ahead with City of Literature, but it was, you know, it wasn't designed so much for lockdown, was it? Whereas this time around, we've had a bit more leeway to try and think of things that kind of take advantage of the slightly weird situation we're all in.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, last year we had a programme all ready to go, you know, nearly 30 events all lined up and ready to press play on. And then, of course, as you say, we had to basically reshape with a really different delivery in mind. So it's been quite a different process for us this year in terms of, you know, where we are, what we've learned in the past year. I mean, like everybody else, we've had to learn really rapidly what works online, what works less well, maybe. And so, yeah, I hope that the programme that we have devised for people has used all that reflection and that learning to present a set of little experiments. That is the hope. but let's see.
And the lovely thing about this programme is that it is a hybrid approach. So we've got a couple of things taking place in Norwich, within the grounds of our building Dragon Hall in a very socially distanced way. But then there are also lots of other experiences and experiments that are taking place completely online that people can access from anywhere in the world.
That's exactly right, Steph. Yeah, and I think that's been a really interesting part of this year. You know, where before we'd be very much programming for people who could come and join us in Norwich and be part of our place with us, and now the whole world is on our doorstep. So it's really quite a different way of thinking about that story that we're trying to tell with the programme.
Should we go from the top and just talk through what is coming up and what people can get involved with? And we should say that everything that we're doing this year is completely free to attend, right?
That's absolutely right. Yeah, everything is completely free. I mean, donations are always welcome to support our work, but absolutely no pressure. And we would just love to have people there with us. So absolutely free to book a place on everything. As you've said, you can, I think apart from two of the pieces, these can be accessed wherever you are in the world. We've just got two parts that are taking place in person. So that's a little bit trickier. You need to come to us. But otherwise, wherever you are, you can join in. And we hope you will.
Yeah, so should we take a look at one of the in-person events? So Provenance, which is actually happening at Dragon Hall.
So yes, yeah, so Provenance is in partnership with our good friends at the UEA in celebration of their 50th anniversary as the UK's first creative writing masters. And it's just such an exciting and experimental and innovative programme where they have commissioned six new pieces of work with UEA graduates. And we're a partner in one of those. And our graduate is Ayobami Adebayo. And she has worked to write a film called Provenance, which will unfold across a triptych of screens in our Great Hall, Dragon Hall, with an actor live kind of telling this absolutely incredible story of a sacred object, the Ebeji, from its creation in Nigeria in 1895 all the way through to present day Norwich. So it's sort of looking at how this seemingly anonymous museum artefact can really hold all these hopes and emotions of a family and a nation. And we've also, as part of that experience, you can hear Ayobami in conversation with Professor Jean McNeil from from the UEA with whom we've been working really closely. So that's a way, I guess, to get under the really behind the curtain of the project. Like, how did Iobami approach this amazing commission? You know, I believe that it was a very broad brief. Anything could happen. And this is the approach that she's decided to take. So that experience, you can come to the building. We've got three showings most days across the festival window, and you can book to be immersed in that experience.
Sounds very exciting. And Iobami was actually on the podcast just over a year ago. So if you want a little teaser of her and her work, then do go and check that out. I think it was episode 83, which was a very long time ago.
Did you have the number to hand, or did you just pluck that off the top of your head because you've catalogued every single episode in your mind?
I did look that up.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah, I don't have a perfect index in my mind.
That is incredible work. I mean, she's an astonishing writer. I mean, her book was Stay With Me, really, really worth your efforts. I mean, which is so exciting to be working with her. And I should say with a creative technology company as well called Mutiny, and they've devised, you know, a lot of the pieces as part of Future and Form, which is the name of the overall project. It's very exciting.
Something else that is inspired by Dragon Hall, but you don't have to be there to experience it. So this is called Tombland, and it features Jay Bernard and Mwen. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
So yeah, so Jay Bernard, some will know, poet, filmmaker, does a lot of work looking at the archives and explore, you know, kind of mixing those things together. They have been our associate artist with us at the National Centre for Writing, and as part of that programme, they wanted to put their energies towards basically building this experimental kind of soundscape in collaboration with Mwen, who is a sound designer and a producer and a DJ. So they spent a little bit of time with us at Dragon Hall. They had a lot of fun, I believe, making up sounds, making up songs, just hanging out in the medieval trading hall and using their sort of interest and their expertise in sound production to basically commune with the lives that have that the Great Hall has seen. I mean, it's an absolutely astonishing space for those who have been to the building. And for those that haven't, we hope you'll be able to sort of meet the building in a really different way. So sort of part jam session, part sketchbook, part EP, and they combine to create this amazing game that you can engage with. It's going to be great. And we've also got a conversation with Jay and with Mwen and a festival producer called Jenny Niven, and they're going to again get really behind the scenes with the project, you know, the who, what, where, why, how they did it, why they did it.
Yeah, no, I'm really looking forward to checking out that and exploring a little virtual version of Dragon Hall. Peggy, what about Weather With You? This is where we've got several writers involved here.
We truly do. So Weather With You, this is part of a big project we've been running called the Ambition for Excellence Project. And that was a way for us to experiment with new work and with new ways of working. And so part of that, we had a little suite of commissions called Open Doors. Some people may have seen that on the website a little while back. We were going to be working to commission basically new work. And the idea of Weather With You, really, again, avid podcast listeners will remember just around about, I think, February or March last year, we had Jenny Offal on the podcast speaking about her amazing book, Weather. And as part of that work with us, it was just so interesting to get Jenny to reflect on almost the weather around weather. You know, what are the atmospheric pressures that kind of surround a book? That was the idea. That was what came out of that conversation. And so this set of commissions, Weather With You, has asked three writers to just reflect on exactly that and to sort of articulate the really bizarre year we've all had. You know, it has been an extraordinary year. Partly we wanted to hear more about that. We wanted to capture it. You know, we wanted to understand a bit more about what that means to be a writer and to be recording that, really. And so the three writers that we have commissioned pieces from are Derek Owusu, who many will know is the winner of the Desmond Elliott Prize last year for That Reminds Me, which is an utterly stunning book. That's Derek's debut novel. We've commissioned Abir Mukherjee, who's the best-selling author of the award-winning Wyndham and Banerjee series of crime novels. And thirdly, we've worked with Kerini Doherty, who also, her debut book came out in 2020. It's called Thin Places, and it's a sort of mixture of memoir and nature writing set in Ireland. So we've got these three beautiful pieces that people can engage with just as text pieces. We've also got three podcasts with each of the writers coming up. We've got Kerry in conversation with Amy Liptrot, we've got Derek in conversation with Sean Hewitt, and we've got Abir in conversation with Aisha Malik. And then we're bringing Abir and Derek together to discuss it all with Heather Parry.
Yeah, it's going to be an epic week on the podcast. Anyone who likes listening to us will be able to listen to us almost every day, I think.
Yeah. And that's everybody. Come on. That's all of the people.
All the humans.
And we've got another digital resource called Looking Large and Small, which is segueing nicely from some of the bigger questions that we'll be asking in Weather With You and really tuning into the finer details of everyday life.
I love this piece. I'm lucky enough. I mean, obviously it will come, you'll get to see it yourselves in May, but it's just, I've seen it in draft form, as it were, and it's just so beautiful. Mm. Basically, again, part of Open Doors, a new way of working for us. We've commissioned Rowan Hisao Buchanan and Jessica J. Lee, who are both writers in their own right, and they work closely together as well on the Willow Herb Review. But they, Rowan also is an illustrator, and they have worked together to produce just a stunning guide, basically a seasonal guide to the nature around us. So the title, Looking Large and Small, it's sort of about those, both those micro little observations, the little mosses, the little kind of brilliant little wallflowers doing their thing, and then the bigger kind of, you know, the environmental questions, the bigger things, you know, the big trees, the big, you know, the bigger backdrop to this world that we're in. Honestly, I've always been a fan of the great outdoors, but this year especially, all I've done is look closely at stuff. Mm. So I'm personally very invested in this piece. I think it's a really beautiful response to where we are and how important nature is. And what about you? I mean, have you guys found that it's been, you've just been looking more closely at the seasons as they change?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we've all got to know these tiny spaces, haven't we? Because we can't go very far. So we spend much more time in one small area than we would normally. You really start to notice stuff that you would just completely wash over you ordinarily.
Yeah, I think that's it. It's your own neighborhood has become your cinema, really. And so yeah, so this piece is for anyone for whom that is also the case. And it's got little exercises as well, little diary like entries, so you can, you know, sort of go off and do your own explorations of your own wherever you are, I should say. This is not specific to Norwich, although it is specific to the seasons.
Okay, so we then have something called The Group. And I think this is probably something we don't want to tell too much about, because actually part of the excitement here is the mystery and waiting to see how exactly this unfolds. But this is a three-part play that is going to emerge out of WhatsApp for people taking part.
I think it is quite a mysterious and intriguing concept, isn't it? A play that's delivered to you via your phone and via WhatsApp. We've been working with Jack McNamara from New Perspectives Theatre Company, who's been collaborating with a Welsh violinist and composer called Angharad Davies. And together they've produced what's going to be a really atmospheric piece. So if you love unusual and immersive experiences and you want to explore literature, language, drama, you want to hear some beautiful new music by Angharad, digital art, then this is really for you, and you don't even need to leave your home. It's just going to come straight to your phone.
I'm very excited for that one. One more event, which is taking place in Norwich, in the beautiful Plantation Gardens in Norwich, on Saturday the 29th of May. It is in fact fully booked, but you can still join in online.
This event is really in partnership with our good friends at the Book Hive. They run a Page Against the Machine session every Wednesday. Well, they did when the shop was open in more normal days. And it was just bring your own book, have a read. That's all. It's just a sort of carving a little space in the week to have a read. Down tools, have a lovely read, take a little picture and tweet or Instagram us and tell us what you're reading, how you're finding it, what the weather's doing. So it's just a big lovely shared read-along.
And the big finale is, of course, the Harriet Martineau Lecture. So every year we invite someone to come along and celebrate the legacy of Harriet Martineau. And this year we are very excited to have Ella P. Wakatama not coming to Norwich, unfortunately, but you will be able to listen and see this lecture online. Tell us more about it, Peggy.
Yeah, we are so excited to be working with Ella on this, on the lecture this year, which is supported, I should say, with great thanks by the Martineau Society. Ella is a literary critic. She's editor-at-large for Canongate Fiction. She's just a force, you know. She's such a brilliant mind. And she has written a lecture for us, which is called None But Ourselves, which is really, it's about her journey, really, as a reader and as an editor, and who holds those narratives, who decides who's heard. But what's really kind of thrilling this year is we've commissioned a piece by Julian Knox, who is a filmmaker, very exciting young filmmaker and poet. And Julian is working with Ella to basically produce a visual score for the lecture, so that when you tune in, it'll be, you know, a sort of filmic experience with Julian's visuals and Ella's voice delivering the lecture.
you're kind of getting two cool events for the price of one. And in fact, the price is free.
For the price of none. Yeah, it's going to be beautiful.
Steph, if people want to get involved, whether they're based in Norwich or further afield, where can they go to do that?
So head over to nationalcentreforwriting.org.uk/cityoflit-21. And you will find links to all of the events, all of the online and in-person experiences. And as we said, they are all completely free to book.
Fantastic. Okay, so now we'll hand over to Chris talking with Jo Lloyd. This is a really interesting conversation about her writing and going from writing, you know, one award-winning short story to putting together a full collection, Jo's preference for editing over the actual writing itself, and also the differences between being published in America and being published here, particularly if you're working on short fiction. Let's hand over to Chris.
Today, I'm really pleased to be joined by Jo Lloyd on the Writing Life podcast, the author of a new collection of short stories called The Earth, Thy Great Exchequer, Ready Lies, published by Swift Press. Jo, welcome.
Thank you.
It's a real pleasure to have you on the podcast today, and we've got half an hour or so to talk around and through and about this wonderful, diverse collection of stories and to spend a little bit of time talking about your experience both in writing them and also publishing them. I'm trying to kind of avoid a way of saying in these strange times, but I'll just sort of put that in inverted commas and let that go to one side. But I wanted to start by asking you to give readers who haven't yet kind of come across the collection just an introduction to this grouping, this really exquisite grouping of stories, if you would.
Okay, so it's called, as you said, The Earth, Thy Great Exchequer, Ready Lies. And I think that is a title that kind of brings together these stories, which are otherwise quite disparate. They're set in different countries and, above all, in different centuries. They actually alternate. There are stories that are set in older times, and then there's a contemporary story, and then another story that's set in older times, and that's the kind of form that it seemed to me that the collection should take. And they are, as you say, quite diverse, so I always find it quite difficult to sum them up. But I think there is a common theme of a quest. And I'm starting to wonder whether when I say that, I'm simply saying they're fiction, because maybe all fiction deals with quests, but there is a definite questing element in these stories. The title story is about a mine owner who's on a quest for a new source of silver. There's a story about butterfly collectors hunting rare butterflies in pre-World War Europe. There's a young man searching for his lost father. So in many ways, there is a quest theme that runs through them. And I think the other thing to say is that the title, I think, would have meant something very different to the people who read it when it was written, around about 1800. When people really did think that the earth was theirs for the taking. It's your exchequer in that sense. You can help yourself to it. And now I think we think of that in a very different way. The earth is fragile and inexhaustible. It's an exchequer, but it needs protection. But I do think that there is a little of the 18th century attitude in all of us. And a need to keep questioning that border where rights end and obligations begin, what we deserve and what we owe. And I think that is a theme that runs through the collection too.
Yeah, every time I spotted the book on my kind of kitchen table or sort of on my desk at work and read the title again, I felt like I was about to get to my feet in a chapel and begin a great hearty sort of 18th century hymn with the earth, thy great exchequer ready. Like it's very confident sort of hymnic language, isn't it?
It is, but in the service of pure economic greed, it's yes. It's a poem in praise of this mine owner, talking about his mining exploits and past and yet to come. So,
yes, the figure of Humphrey Mackworth, I think, who appears right. in the title story. It's very interesting that you say quest as well. One of the things that I'd sort of felt connected the stories was also acquisition.
Right. I guess I can see that. I mean, most particularly in that story,
yeah.
but also possibly in The Invisible, there is some exploration of who has what.
Yes, and obviously with Dotty and Prue, who are butterfly hunting as well. And there are, well, I suppose when I mean acquisition, I suppose I mean people who are searching to acquire and also people who have lost what they thought they had acquired or what they needed.
Right, that's really interesting.
The switch that you outline in the kind of the attitude between those who would have originally heard that line, the earth thy great exchequer ready lies, and how we read it now is a really fascinating kind of metaphor, if you like, or for the power of the short story, perhaps, and how it can kind of take something and spin it right on its axis and give you exactly the opposite. Is there something about the power of the short story that is attractive to you for that reason?
Well, there is definitely something about the power of the short story that I have fallen in love with over the years. One is often asked why short stories, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that for me, certainly, the original answer to that was that short stories are manageable. When you first start writing, the idea of doing a novel is not manageable, and the idea of writing short stories is manageable, and that's quite a mundane reason. But as I went on writing, I read more and more and more short stories and absolutely fell in love with the form and still consider it to be the perfect literary form. Mm. It's such an intense hit of everything that we love in literature.
I think the intensity is something that also rings true. And I think about the range and the nature of the stories in this collection. Quite often a writer will kind of find an environment or a voice or a set of interests that carries across and gives a degree of similarity to their stories. But I kind of felt in your case that there was such a huge diversity of kind of time set and voice taken and attitude taken. But where do you see the connections between your stories?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think in recent years, there's been this real tendency to perhaps for prizes and national and interest to be in short stories collection that have a common theme, mm-hmm. And link short story collections perhaps. But I think a lot of short story lovers don't necessarily want that. They do want diversity. For me, certainly, I want diversity in a short story collection. I want a selection box. I don't want just all the purple Quality Streets. I want, I want a whole range of Quality Streets, and throw in some sushi too, and that's fine. And the other thing to say is that these stories were written over 10 years. So yeah. I think there is some change of interest over time and some change in my ability to handle the material, I'm sure.
Well, we might come back to that because, you know, it is kind of a collection that's come together over a long period of time, more like perhaps poetry than a novel in that sense, although obviously some novels do take decades to write. I kind of want to go back to that short story question again. When I sort of first picked up the collection and thinking about your formal choices of breaking, many of the short stories are broken down into episodes with their own sort of titles. I just wondered kind of what you felt or what prompted you to begin that, and why pursue that particular formal choice?
One of the answers is that I get bored very easily, and when I contemplate the idea of moving a character from the end of the corridor through the door into the room, I get bored with that. I don't want to do that. And those section breaks do give you a way to swiftly move to a different place. Mm. So I think that may be the main reason.
No, that's a very good reason. It kind of, as a reader, it's a really interesting experience of both sort of pressing the pause button, but while still maintaining the kind of momentum that had previously accumulated. It felt like constantly adjusting a point of view somehow while kind of keeping in the center of something. I got to really appreciate it as the collection kind of moved on, and it really helped me orient myself, I think, in the stories.
That was good. Your explanation for it sounds so much more crafty than mine. But
yeah, that sounds like Cindy, who describes the crafty craft or the arty artfulness of some of the pictures.
It's actually the me in the story.
Oh, who does it? Yeah.
Well, she describes Cindy describing it. Yes. Look at the craftiness of this.
Yeah, I suddenly became that character for a moment. Can we talk a little bit about The Invisible, the story that kind of won the BBC Short Story Prize in 2019, and that in some ways it doesn't stand at the heart of the collection, or it doesn't stand at the start or the end of the collection, but it does sort of emanate throughout the collection. And could you tell me a little bit about the genesis of that story?
Yeah, that's actually one of the few stories that has a really simple genesis. There were two things that coincided that maybe started, and then I wrote it actually quite quickly for me. So the two things were I caught sight of a line in the online Welsh Dictionary of Biography about this character, Martha. I think she was described as a voluble hypocrite or something. And, as a writer, you think, what? You're going to go, occupation, voluble hypocrite. You're going to look into that, right? Right. So when I looked into it a little further and read the entry on her, it described her as being visited by these invisible wealthy people. And that further interested me, and particularly the fact that they were wealthy. That seemed such an odd detail to be attached to invisible people. And at the same time, a friend's mother was in hospital and she was being visited by invisible people. So those two things together, those were what inspired the story. And I was interested in perhaps exploring a slightly different explanation of it from her just being a hypocrite. And then it seemed such a rich theme. It went off in all directions. The idea of this invisible wealthy nation of people living alongside this very poor farming community. As I say, I wrote it quite quickly for me. I think it was the first draft was pretty much finished in 3 months, which is for me very quick.
Yeah, and when was that written, if I might ask?
So I started it in the August of 2018, mm-hmm. and I finished it. The final word that I changed was on March the 8th, 2019, when I entered it for the BBC.
Brilliant. And kind of, you'd published quite a lot and kind of won awards before that point, but that kind of BBC prize was a moment where you really sort of caught the attention of kind of the readers here in this country more. What was the experience like for you now you've had sort of a little bit of distance on it?
Well, I say this all the time. It's an absolutely fantastic opportunity for writers. As you say, I'd achieved a few things in the US. I published in some of my favorite magazines, want to know Henry, but I'm sure nobody in Britain knew who I was at all. And the BBC does completely change things. Your profile is completely different. I mean, I'd never even thought of getting an agent before that. Mm-hmm. But once I'd won it, then I was in the position of talking to several agents. So, yeah, things completely changed.
And with your experience in kind of publishing in the US market, was that one of necessity because the short story seems still to be more prized and more popular there than it is here? Or was it happenstance or design?
It was necessity because there were just so few outlets. I say were because I think there's a couple more now. Short Fiction and The Lonely Crowd are two outlets that I think are accessible to emerging writers. Mm. I don't think places like Granta are accessible to emerging writers, mm-hmm. Unless you're very fortunate or well-connected. I don't know how it works. And there, as you say, there are just very few places for emerging writers to publish in this country. It was actually the Scottish writer Nick Holdstock who suggested to me trying the American market, and I'm forever grateful to him because I don't know what I would have done otherwise. You see a lot of emerging writers these days that seem to just keep entering the small competitions, mm-hmm. And I don't blame them because what else can they do? But I don't think it's necessarily the best route to publishing more in the places you really want to publish.
That's interesting. What do you think what would be a better option?
Publish in America.
Yeah.
there are just so many more journals in America, and that they range from the small and with the small circulation perhaps and very open to newer writers to obviously the very choosy and large. But there is something for everybody, and if you do the research, it is possible. I mean, the other thing we'd like to see, obviously, is more outlets in this country.
Yeah. I noticed, I think I read, it may have been, I can't remember which interview it was, that you, when you were asked at the end of an interview, shortly after the BBC Prize, what you were going to do next, you said you were surprised to find yourself putting together a collection.
I know it seems odd, but I had not been thinking of it before. I think I had said to several people I wasn't ready to put together a collection. Mm-hmm. And then once I won the BBC, I suddenly found myself doing that. And I think part of that is that it seemed like a good opportunity. There was, if I was ever going to be able to publish a collection, it seemed like then was the time. But also it seemed like I had achieved a few ambitions and it was maybe time to consolidate that.
And in terms of your experience of putting that collection together, was there anything that particularly surprised you about the process or that halted you a bit?
I knew absolutely nothing. Everything has been a surprise to me. Everything, really.
In terms of the actual editorial choices you've had to make and the sense of your collection that you've had to develop yourself or the actual publishing business or both?
The publishing business, how I would feel about it, I think one of the things that really took me by surprise was how everybody in publishing knows each other. I didn't know that was true before, but it is. They all know each other. I think they all actually live together in a house.
They're just not telling you the address.
That's right.
It is remarkable how the kind of certain parts of the publishing world are so densely connected. Mm-hmm. In terms of the editorial side of things and kind of working kind of putting in the work yourself to put the collection together. How did you find that as a task as a writer? Did you have to become your own reader in a new way?
Well, I'm very much my own reader anyway. I love the editing process. Mm-hmm. I'm not a big fan of the drafting process, but I love the editing process. I've just been reading George Saunders on his process, and when he talks about reiterating, I very much, that's my way of working too. So I would say there wasn't much editing on a sentence or paragraph level that was needed by the time we got to putting together the collection. Mm-hmm. What I found really difficult was choosing an order. It seemed to me there was out there somewhere a perfect order for these stories, and I had to find it. So I put them all in different coloured folders depending on certain themes. I had some spreadsheets that told me what sort of, about different variations between them, you know, that the kind of the person telling the story, the gender, the age, the whether it was a funny story or a serious story. And I did go for variety. I wanted variety, so I tried to arrange the different colours to make a nice pattern.
Yeah,
I wonderful. Spent a long
like
time doing
taxonomy
that.
Taxonomy almost, like Dotty and Prue with their butterflies.
Yeah, I might identify a little bit with taxonomists.
there's a deep satisfaction in that bringing of order.
Absolutely.
And that there's a clear echo in the stories there that search for order. I think about poor John, as I keep calling him in my head, in Deep Shelter, and that kind of search for that.
He is poor John, is he? I think he's quite a figure of a certain amount of tragedy.
Yeah, very quiet, sort of kind of muted or dampened tragedy, but nonetheless.
And I think because of his age and time, one of the things I wanted to capture in him was that kind of a character that you seem to see in people of that age who'd have been through those experiences, quite a dignified kind of quietness and certainly a sort of a suppressed emotionality.
Yes, I think there was a point where he was kind of going to the South Bank, the Festival of Britain site, I think, and he was kind of saw the older generation kind of ramrod straight, and then the younger generation who'd cast off their jackets and ties, and he put his coat back on, and I felt so sad. Felt like it was all lost for him. Anyway, that was just my reaction. I wanted to kind of come back. There's a really beautiful quotation from an interview you gave where you said that you wanted to be able to hold the whole of a story in your head and yet not quite. And I just wanted to ask you kind of what that feeling was that you were aiming for with a short story that you'd written, and what it was that you wanted to hold and what you felt that you wouldn't be able to hold.
So I guess I think as a writer, it's important to be able to hold the whole thing in your head in order to feel that you've got the shape right. And it has to get to, for me, it has to get quite far along before you can do that. Mm. But once it's got to a certain stage, you can feel the shape of it and where a little bit needs tweaking, a little bit needs to come away here, a little bit more needs here. You can feel that. But if you could really hold it all in your head, it almost wouldn't be worth it, because I feel it has to expand beyond that. There has to be... certainly, I mean, I'm not a great believer in consciously thinking about the craft and the themes of whatever of a story. I think a lot happens on an unconscious level. We call it intuition, but I think it's really experience and not just the experience of being a writer, but obviously all the experiences you've had in your life and all the reading experiences you've had. And I think that all feeds in unconsciously, and if you're in too much conscious control of that, I think the story is less rich.
You're kind of searching for a balance between control and a point of kind of freedom or a lack of control where it might all escape.
I think that's right, yes.
Oh, interesting. Did you study creative writing kind of in higher education sense? Obviously, many people, you haven't at all.
I studied English literature.
Yeah. And do you think, there's no kind of right answer to the question, but for you it was the right thing not to study creative writing, or do you feel like you missed anything by not doing so?
Oh, I think I would have loved to have done that. I'm not sure it would have been good for me, but I would definitely have loved to do it.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, isn't it? Whether it would be
imagine spending 3 years just thinking about writing, I think that would be great.
Has your writing life sort of changed radically since the BBC Prize?
Yes. So since the prize, immediately after the prize, I was completely concentrating on putting together the collection. There were the two, my agent, Lucy Luck, suggested we needed a couple of unpublished stories. So I was working on those. They were stories that I had around, not finished, but they did need finished. So there was a period of working on those and then putting the collection together and getting in the right order and all that. And so at that point, once it was finalized, I think it marked a completion of a phase for me. Mm-hmm. And time to move on to something new. But don't ask what the something new is, because I don't know.
That's all right. Perhaps not knowing it is the novelty at the moment. In terms of you describe yourself as being really kind of passionate about the editing stage and less so about the drafting stage. Do you find it problematic to get through the drafting stage? You say it takes you, quite a while. Do you ever get stuck?
So there's two things here. I think one of the reasons it can take a long time is because for a number of these stories, there's quite a lot of research involved, and that takes a long time. Mm. And the other reason is, I get stuck. I think I often start off with a very fluid paragraph or two or a page or two that is at that time the beginning. It might not end up as the beginning, but when I do it, it feels like the beginning of the story. And then after that, it's often simply a blank. I don't really know what comes next. I sometimes know where it's going, but I don't know how it's going to get there. And it's that phase of filling in that bit that does take me a long time.
How do you kind of keep yourself at the page, if you like?
Bribe myself. If you spend 10 minutes filling in this bit here where you've just put blah, blah, then you can spend 10 minutes doing something else.
Excellent. Kind of it's good old-fashioned carrots and sticks.
Yep.
Gosh, yeah, it's a proper negotiation. Proper negotiation with the subconscious and that sort of feeling of intuition.
Yes.
And do you know when kind of a subject matter, a character, or a kind of a bump in your daily experience arrives that that's going to be something that you will have to write about?
Well, I write down lots of things. I think I've learned that I can't remember anything that I think I will need. You know, when something strikes you as an idea and you think, and it seems so clear and present, you think obviously you're going to remember it, but I have learned that I never do. So now I have to write down every single thing that strikes me, whether it's a sentence in a corner of a story or an idea for a story. I have to write it all down, but obviously a huge amount of that doesn't get used.
That marvelous siren call of the "I will never forget this thing." Yeah. It's so clear and perfect.
<That's>
fatal. Well, I can absolutely guarantee that anyone who, after listening to this, picks up the collection will not be disappointed in terms of the kind of linguistic freshness, the turns, the beauty of the sentences and the richness of theirs. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, even bigger pleasure to read the collection. It's been a real joy, in fact, and I wish you the very best of luck with it. And have you got plans to publish more in the coming kind of 12 months, or are you just going to kind of see where things take you for the time being?
I have to write something.
Yeah, as I was saying that, I thought, I think there's going to be a while to wait. Anyway, there's plenty enough material here for readers to kind of come back to again and again. So I really recommend it highly. And thank you for joining us today, Jo.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening, and many thanks to Jo and Chris for that brilliant conversation. If you have any questions about that or about our City of Literature programme, or in fact anything else that we do, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Writers' Centre. Check out our Facebook page or head over to our website at nationalcentreforwriting.org.uk, where you can sign up for Steph's amazing weekly newsletter.
That is the title of the newsletter. Don't forget, as a UK registered charity, we rely on the generosity of our supporters to make our work possible. Please do consider making a donation to us by visiting nationalcentreforwriting.org.uk and hitting the support us button.
Steph, I nearly forgot to mention Discord.
Do it.
So we also have a Discord online community, which is full of writers from around the world chatting about what they're writing, what they're reading, sharing tips and techniques and all that kind of stuff. If you would like to join, it's completely free. You can find a link to the community down in the show notes. Please do rate, review and follow the podcast using your favourite podcast app. That does help other people to find it as well. And we're all about trying to help as many writers as we possibly can. Peggy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you both for having me. It's been a delight, as always.
Thanks again. Keep writing, and we'll catch you on the next episode.